This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
I'm so pleased to be introducing Wayne Pacelli for his new book, The Humane Economy: How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. Wayne is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Humane Society of the United States, though I think most of you probably know that. At the Humane Society, he's focused on far-reaching substantive measures to effect real change and has led countless reforms and ballot campaigns. He is the New York Times bestselling author of The Bond, Our Kinship with Animals and Our Call to Defend Them. The Humane Economy is both a fierce and optimistic book about the potential role of business and commerce in making meaningful, lasting strides in the treatment of animals. It is a crucial call to action. Wayne will be in conversation tonight with two other great thinkers. In 2010, Kathleen Parker received the Pulitzer Prize for commentary for her perceptive, witty, often witty columns on an array of political and moral issues, gracefully sharing the experiences and values that led her to unpredictable conclusions. She is the author of Save the Males, Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care. And she, writes...
I need to read that book.
Yeah. I just don't know why that always gets a laugh.
It's a great con.
I have to give it to my ex-girlfriend.
And she writes the Washington Post on the intersections between politics, community, and culture. And she just published a really beautiful piece on Wayne's new book. Senator Cory Booker's contributions to social justice and political change are well known, first as mayor of Newark and then as a senator representing New Jersey. What is less known to the general public is his ongoing commitment, both personally and politically, to the ethical and fair treatment of animals. Just a couple months ago, we did an event together at Sixth and I for his new book, United, and someone asked him if he would perhaps be part of a ticket in 2016. "There is no question I will be a VP this year," he said with a straight face. "I will always be a vegan practitioner." Please help me welcome Kathleen Parker, Senator Cory Booker, and Wayne Pacelli to Sidwell Friends.
Welcome, everybody, and thanks so much for coming out tonight. I've been given the pleasure of starting, and I wanted to say, first of all, that when I was asked, I must be the luckiest girl in D.C., at least, maybe the world, because I am seated with two of the best-looking vegans in the world.
There's only a smattering of applause there. It wasn't like the ones before.
Well, in preparation for tonight, I wanted to sort of get in the mood, so I've been kind of going around the neighborhood and just picking up, discarded nuts and eating, some of the cabbages left over in the window boxes, and the hostas are just coming up; they're delicious. I've been so successful that I've lost 5 pounds, and the rabbits are now hunting me. That's not a joke, but I do have one. And it goes like this. Someone sent this to me this morning in response to the column I had written about the humane economy. And it goes like this. Guy 1 says to Guy 2, "My dog is a vegan." Guy 2 says, "How do you know?" Guy 1 says, "He won't stop talking about it." The truth is we don't talk enough about it, about the humane economy and about, how we can reduce and minimize the amount of suffering, animal suffering in the world in a variety of sectors. And the book that Wayne has written is fantastic. I've read it, of course, in preparation for tonight. And it's, he's making the case, which I will let him talk about in a minute, but the case that, it's profitable, actually, to treat animals humanely. And the Humane Society has done an amazing job of getting corporations on board. And I'll just turn it over to Wayne to tell you about the book.
Thank you. And what a great honor it is to be between these two luminaries, not just on animals, but in so many other domains, the top of your profession of journalism and opinion writing. And this guy is just incredible. I mean, what a joy to have him in the United States Senate working on animals.
Thank you.
Corey is leading the fight on animal protection in the United States Congress, and Kathleen has written about these issues many, many times, and she does it like nobody else. So it is a great honor to be here, and thanks to each one of you for coming out tonight. This really does mark the official launch of this book tour. And I do have a busy day job as CEO of HSUS, and I wanted to write this book, though, because I really feel like this movement is at a tipping point. It's at an inflection point. And one of the explanations for that is the public is really starting to understand that animals matter. They think, they feel, they suffer. And we have so many interactions with the other creatures of this world. So many of them are wonderful. So many of them reflect empathy and kindness and mercy. But there's also this other side of this equation where we humans are misusing our power in industrial agriculture, in trophy hunting, in trapping and fur farming and horse slaughter and horse soaring, and so many other problems that we confront every day of the year. And ever since I was a kid, I cared about animals and loved animals. But I didn't know that all these problems existed for animals. And it was at the point of learning about these problems that I decided I didn't want to be a bystander, and I wanted to do something about these problems. And I've been so fortunate to have been with the Humane Society of the United States for more than two decades now. And when I started, Kathleen, when I became a vegan when I was 19, I mean, very few people had heard of the term. Nobody could pronounce it. And now it's a different world. And that is just one indicator of a broader consciousness that's taking hold in our society. And Corey has been fighting on these issues. I mean, he's doing an amazing job. There's a bill right now in the Congress to reform and strengthen a law that was first enacted in 1976 dealing with toxic substances. There are 85,000 chemicals in use in our society, commercial use, with 2,700 of them in high-volume use. And animal testing as a method of risk assessment was the primary response of the regulators in trying to see if we're going to be poisoned by these chemicals. And it hasn't been working. It's been tremendously costly. And over the 40-year history of this law, only five chemicals have been pulled from the market. Corey has a provision in a bill that's being negotiated between the House and the Senate right now to set a standard, which is such a reasonable standard, saying if we can use alternatives to animal testing, and some of these alternatives really reflect the best of 21st century science, shouldn't we do that? Because there's a moral cost to killing these animals, to poisoning them with high volumes of these toxic substances that really are not very predictive for our own circumstance in terms of safety and risk. And I tell you, I have been involved in political activity for many years, and this is one of the cases where literally Corey and his staff, with his staffer Adam Zipkin in particular, they absolutely were determined to get this provision in the bill, got it in the Senate bill, and this has the potential to save millions of lives. So, Corey, thank you very much.
I have a question for you, Corey. I'm sure that everybody would like to hear more about that bill, but also I'm asking whether, is this something that you have bipartisan support for, and who are some of the other people in the Senate, for example, who are willing to work on these issues? And
so let me just say, first and foremost, I work with lots of advocacy groups, lots of folks that will come into your office and advocate for things, but I've really met no one as masterful in moving the society forward as Wayne. He is incredible at approaching this in a bipartisan manner. And so as much as I... As much as I want to take credit, I'm very new to the United States Senate. I've been here in the Senate for about 2.5 years. But having him and his whole team, again, he's got an incredible team around him, as partners has helped us to, you know, make an impact on a lot of different issues and help to enlighten a lot of my partners. Now, before I even showed up on the scene, you had a lot of Republicans in the House and the Senate. He had an event the other night, and I love going to Humane Society events because, as a guy who obviously likes to eat, it's hard going to these Washington cocktail parties where they have like pigs in a blanket and all this. But Wayne, I walk in and there's like this huge buffet of food. At the end of it, this like stacks high, like 4 feet high of cupcakes, and I don't even have to think; it's all vegan. And so basically, I have. So just picture me over in the corner, not chewing, not masticating, but inhaling cupcakes, really breaking some kind of Senate record. And meanwhile, I'm looking up at Wayne, who's at this like little step and repeat area, and I'm watching the who's who from the Capitol on both sides of the political aisle. I mean, when John McCain walked in, I said, oh my gosh. Please don't see me, John, because he'll punch me in the face. No, I love John. He's actually a really gentle giant in the Senate. But you had Republicans and Democrats, and it was one of the best scenes I've seen in Washington because it's rare to have an organization that's not about our veterans where you see that many people. I saw Jeff Flake come through. I saw Tulsi Gabbard. It was just on both sides of the political aisle. It's something that you've done. And I want to—I highlighted something in this book that I want to read, but not quite yet. But how did you—how do you pull that off by having such both parts? I mean, Vitter is one of the great allies of mine in the Senate. One of the guys that's really passionate about these issues.
See, everyone has a redeeming something.
Well, I will say that the thing that I've learned in politics over the years is it's great to have bipartisan support, especially when you have a country that's divided. I mean, the arithmetic works only one way. You've got to get to 50 plus one. But the most important thing is leadership. When you have a lawmaker who cares about issues and cajoles other members and who will not take no for an answer, which is what I saw with this, that is really the difference in politics. And I see that with very few lawmakers.
We've got to somehow, Kevin, you have to help us move, because this is just going to be a competition of him saying nice things about me.
I know, can we all just acknowledge these two guys are fabulous and we'll move on to the issues now, okay?
Let me talk about something. Let me just say something. Let me get beyond this, because that's the first time I heard him spew crap.
Look at this book. You really did tear it up.
I tore this up.
Really?
First of all, please buy this book. And the reason why I'm saying buy this book is because I expected, frankly, a 300-page rant about which I would have applauded. I would have got up and down and jumped up and down. But it was so much different than I expected. I'm on his side on all of these issues. There is a gentility and a kindness in this book.
See, there you go again.
I know, but I'm gonna go to the text.
I'm gonna interrupt.
But let me just read this. So in Washington, you don't hear people talking about their opponents in such a way. You really don't. It's almost become a time where what more attention is on is a vilification of those people that oppose you. But here you're talking about the egg industry. And I was a vegetarian since 1992. And back then, when I would tell somebody at a restaurant I'm a vegetarian, they would look at me, do you eat chicken? No, I'm a vegetarian. Do you eat fish? No, I'm a vegetarian. And so now I became a vegan 2 years ago, and my mom can't pronounce it. She goes, you're a vegan, aren't you? And I'm like, Mom, you watch too much Star Trek from Vegas. But so this is how Wayne talks about somebody from the people from the egg industry. And I've watched the egg industry and the lobbyists. I saw what happened with Just Mayo, which was astonishing to me to see the conspiracy going on between government actors that are supposed to be objective, literally jumping to the aid of a food company. And he writes about this amazing He writes about this amazing food company called Hampton Creeks that is developing vegan alternatives that don't taste like the vegan alternatives I've often tasted, which are horrendous. But this is, if you taste the mayo from Just Mayo, Hampton Creek, it is ridiculously good. I now slather it on many things. But this is you talking about the egg industry, which was a line that I stopped because this is so much of what my beliefs are, is that we talk about tolerance in this country, and I think that we've done ourselves a disservice because tolerance is sort of a cynical state of mind. I'm just tolerating you. I'm stomaching your right to be different. When we should be moving to a society and aspiring to be a society of patriotism, which is love. Love necessitates love of country, necessitates love of your fellow man and fellow woman. Love recognizes, even though we might disagree with each other, that I still recognize your worth and I still recognize your value. So here he is talking about an egg industry, and one of the reasons we can talk about a lot of the reasons I became vegan, but I was shocked when I read about baby chicks being born, and then I saw the video, and they look at to figure out what gender they are, and the cute little chicks that can produce eggs, they put them on one side, and the male chicks, they just drop in a garbage disposal right away. And so this is an industry that you say, during this advocacy, during the process, despite my antipathy for the systems they oversaw, I learned that these egg producers are good, hard-working people who chose their production methods to boost efficiency. You show a level of willing to go and understand the other side and see their humanity, see that they're good people, and you're not trying to, like, in other words, vilify them, but really come to an understanding. And then what I think you do great in the book is pivot to how we get as a society towards win-wins that create more economic activity, more compassion. And I think that's a rare thing in Washington.
I think that is really the big question is, how do you get, a lot of people don't want to hear about this. They simply want to go to the grocery store, get the pork chops, go home, eat them. And, they just really don't want to be bothered. But I think if they did know more about how these animals are processed, it's bound to bother enough other people to build some sort of cumulative mass and change some things. But one of the things in your book, you talk really about these free market approaches to meat alternative products, some of which sound like they came right out of the Jetsons vending machine. I've been waiting so long for that. But how do you go about sort of raising consciousness without making people feel like you're trying to interfere with not only how they eat, but really, frankly, it comes right down to, it's meat eating is so entrenched in our community, in our culture. We got to have a hot dog at the football game. We have to have turkeys at Thanksgiving and on and on. And by the way, when you spoke of the little chick, I thought about that magnificent scene of Sarah Palin outside of the turkey slaughterhouse. I can never quite get enough of Sarah.
Well, this you have captured really what is one of the great challenges in our movement, that this cause is not an abstraction. It's not like democracy in the Middle East, which, I think any sensible person wants to see ideas of democracy and civil society spread, but there's not a lot that we can do about it, right? I mean, it's far away. We're not citizens of those societies. There are things we can do to promote that. There are groups that promote democracy. We can help the people to some extent. But animal issues intersect with our lives in a very real way. It asks something of us, right? Because we run into, through our daily commerce, the use of animals. And while we may not be committing any violence against animals directly, we are connected to that violence through supply chains that might be 10 miles long or 100 miles long or 1,000 miles long. So when I've been to these egg farms, back to your point, Corey, I went to an egg farm in Iowa that has 10 million laying hens at one facility. 10 million. So the hens are kept in small wire cages, and for those of you familiar with our work, you know about it, but each cage has 6 or 8 birds, and each bird has 67 square inches of space, which is about two-thirds the size of this sheet of paper, and they don't get out for the year or year and a half that they're alive. Now imagine if me and you and Corey and 5 or 6 people here, like Congresswoman McSally, are in a small elevator, and if you were stuck in there for 10 or 15 minutes, you would start to freak out. You would get panicked. You would start to feel claustrophobic. Imagine if you were in there for an hour or 10 hours or a day, and then biological functions take over, the waste accumulates right among all of the living. These birds are in this condition and in this place with no way out for their entire lives. And somehow we become accustomed to this. Or it's so far removed from our daily experience that we don't even think about it. And one of the things that's happening in the information age is that the gap between what we believe and what really happens is shrinking. And people are now starting to see, because of undercover investigations or documentaries or great column writing, the reality of what happens, and it asks people of conscience to take action, but it's still tough because our habits are so hardwired in us. You know, we've been doing the things that we do for so long. Every one of us has habits. And when you think about food, it's so fundamental and it's so personal. You don't want to be making moral judgments about people. I mean, I remember at the dining hall when I turned vegan, I wasn't even proselytizing on the issue, but just eating that way provoked defensive reactions from people. So I think what we have to do is, you know, not try to stir people's passions in a negative way and be judgmental, but to speak the truth about what's going on and ask people to honor their own standards. If you believe that animal cruelty is wrong, keeping hens in this kind of condition is wrong. It is shameful. But as Corey, you said, you know, I met these guys and none of them want to be cruel. They take intentional efforts to minimize the suffering, but there is inherent difficulty and inherent inhumanity in that production system, which is why the Congress should have dealt with this issue. And when the egg industry said, we want to deal with it, the pork and beef lobby said, no, we don't want any animal welfare standards at all. And that was a terrible case of congressional gridlock on an issue that was so obvious that the community that was affected by the policy wanted it, yet others blocked it because they didn't want the Humane Society to have a win. We then, as I talk about in the book, went to the corporate sector and have now, with our great colleagues in our Farm Animal Protection Department, have run the table with the big-name brands in the United States, Walmart, McDonald's, Burger King, Cracker Barrel, have all said we're going to phase out our purchase of eggs from operations that confine the hens in this way. And one final thing, I just want to say it was a political science lesson for me. And one aspect of this book is the interplay between the Congress and state legislatures and the courts and the corporations and public attitudes and creative works like documentaries or book writing. All of these things together are adding up to the change that we're seeing. And this book really pulls those strands together and tries to explain how change happens. Yeah. A lot of change is happening. We've got a lot more work to do, but I'm excited about the change.
Well, for example, the film that was done, Blackfish, about the orcas at SeaWorld, I mean, that really led to the SeaWorld agreeing not to do any more breeding of orcas, so that will eventually cease to be entertainment, if that can be considered such. But I'm wondering, too, Corey, what do you say about what the government role in animal welfare should be?
So you hit on something that really, I think, is a point to that question, which is, and this is, again, one of the reasons why I consider you a friend and respect you so much. This is the government calling me right now.
Some social media.
They have hacked into our phones, people. One of the things that you write early in your book, which I think is an interesting tribute to the free market and to rational economic actors, is he says very clearly that this theory of economics, which I buy into, presupposes having information. That consumers, when they have information, we make rational decisions. The problem is we have entire industries that are trying to work very hard not to lift the veil that reconnects us to the earth, to the animals, and to the like. And it's gotten so dramatic that, because people are really good, it's gotten so dramatic that there are legislatures around our country that are passing so-called ag-gag laws to try to stop us from knowing, consumers, from knowing what's going on. And again, that's what I love about you, when you have this fundamental faith in who we are. And if we could start getting that expansion of consciousness where people understand what's really happening, it, in very dramatic ways, it changes consumer behavior. And so for me, and this is where I partner well with conservatives, most people have never heard of the U.S. mark. Okay, I never heard about it until an expose on the front page of the New York Times. And I called up Adam Zipkin and Matt Clapper, my chief of staff, who's here, and just started screaming at them, call Wayne, we've got to do something. Because I didn't know we spend, us as taxpayers, $1 billion a year for subsidizing the animal industrial industries by running experimentations for them about how we can get gruesome experiments, but how can we get eggs to hens to lay more eggs, or pigs to have more piglets. The deformities, when you read this expose, it was so chilling to me. U.S. MARC stands for Meat Animal Research Center. And we're spending our taxpayer dollars doing this. Why are we subsidizing such inhumanity, such cruelty, such experiments, really out of a science fiction movie, the kind of evil experiments? But it doesn't stop at that. We're subsidizing, I love the, what is it, wildlife services. It almost sounds like it's really nice and pretty that we're subsidizing something called wildlife services. What is that? That's so ranchers who have, you know, herds of cattle or whatever, the government, we pay the people that go out and shoot predators that might get too close to their cattle. Often, frankly, not getting, and this is a whole issue with wolves, frankly, that aren't actually really a threat even to them. So this is where my conservative friends are right. Why should the government be playing that role, taxpayer dollars, be spending hundreds of millions of dollars? And by the way, God forbid we fund research into food proteins and the like that can create alternatives like impossible foods that are so incredible. And by the way, save us water, save us environmental damage that these industries do. So for me, it's in the Washington context, it's often easy to have these conversations to try to do what we need to do. It's government's role. Should be not doing things like subsidized industries, but also creating more transparency in what's really going on.
Well, is there any thought to having something like a Booker Amendment, sort of the way we have the Hyde Amendment, you know, that no taxpayer dollars can be used to fund abortion because it's so objectionable to so many people? So why couldn't there be something like
that? Well, the problem is there are so many different categories of animal use and exploitation. And when you try to deal with predator control, for instance, you get the NRA wants to have the government involved in predator control because some of their members want to shoot the deer and elk that the wolves and mountain lions kill, even though they do it ecologically and they do it out of necessity. And then the state ag departments want it because, you know, that's a subsidy for the ranchers that they're allied with. The state fish and game agencies want it because they're trying to procure game for the hunters. And you get this incredible assembly of different groups. I've never seen anything like this. We did an amendment years ago to stop lethal predator control. Government funding of lethal predator control by our, you know, federal trappers using airplanes and leg hole traps and poisons, killing wildlife on our public lands. We won the vote, and then the leadership at the time scheduled a revote in a half hour, and they twisted 30 arms like that, and they reversed the vote. I mean, it's the power of some of the interest groups that we're fighting. The difference then and now is that we're strong enough to stand up to them. And that's why... That's why it's so important that animal protection as a cause has a powerful group that can stand up to the Farm Bureau and stand up to the NRA and stand up to these other interest groups who've used their muscle, and why it's important to have people like Cory Booker and Martha McSally and others who are really passionate about animal issues. Congresswoman McSally, when she was campaigning in southern Arizona, would disrupt her campaign events if she saw a dog who was running on the street. This man runs into buildings and helps animals and people who are at risk. I mean, that's the sort of leadership that we need, people who really are passionate about caring for the world.
Before, if we can leave the domestic scene for just a minute, I'd really love to hear you talk a bit about what you're doing to protect wildlife in other countries. You know, what can we do? What are we doing about elephants and rhinos and chimpanzees and on and on? I know you've been very active all over the place. So.
Well, we are because, you know, we live in a global economy. Information is global. Transport is global. And the field of battle, if you care about animals, is now global, not by our choosing, but by circumstance. And animals are the same, no matter they're in the United States or in Canada or in Mexico or in Mongolia or India or wherever they are. So with our Humane Society International, led by my colleague Kitty Block and Andrew Rowan, we're doing great stuff. We're active in more than 50 countries now, and we're going to get to 75 countries in the next 4 or 5 years. One thing that I've discovered is that people all over the world care about animals, and that this is not just some sort of Western movement. People in Asia, people in Africa care. And I tell you, in Africa, after we saw the barbaric killing of Cecil by a very privileged trophy hunter from Minnesota who used his wealth not to help the wildlife of Africa or not to help the people of Africa, but to put another trophy on his wall. He spent tens of thousands of dollars for that selfish act to squash out this living being for no good purpose. This incredible, beautiful creature who just wanted to live and get a drink of water like the rest of us want in this world. And it really stirred the conscience of people. And thank goodness it did, because we saw this image of this grinning dentist over this beautiful lion that he had killed for pleasure. And what happened, and this is an example that I cite in the Humane Economy, is that 45 airlines, in response to people like you and you and you, who were outraged by this, said, you know, you airlines need to be part of the solution. Don't carry their trophies. Don't carry lion trophies. Don't carry elephant trophies. Don't carry rhino trophies. And 45 airlines said, we're going to stop that. An amazing example of the humane economy forming before our very eyes. And it was great to see. And, you know, I really believe that so many of these African nations that are possessed with rich wildlife populations, it's one of the greatest assets they have. I mean, so many people go to these African countries because
you want to see the animals. You don't want to kill them or eat them.
What is the market potential for trophy hunting? There are a few thousand people who want to shoot these elephants.
Did I read correctly that lion, well, I know the airlines have participated, but isn't it now illegal to bring in a lion head?
Well, yes. Corey and other senators and we at the Humane Society pushed the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to get lions listed as threatened and endangered. And under our Federal Endangered Species Act, that triggers import restrictions on their parts. So now the trophy hunters have to meet a very, very high bar and prove that their killing is somehow contributing to the saving of the species. I mean, if that's not, you know, destroying the village to save it, I haven't heard that kind of logic in 40 years. So, you know, we are working hard on that, and we're working hard on lots of issues. Obviously, so many of these problems for animals relate to our human population. We're crowding a lot of them out.
But if you're just, even if you don't care about the animals, let's just assume that, you do a moral math in here that to me is just phenomenal about what's better for an African country, a dead elephant or a live elephant. And this is what I was so impressed with the mathematics. A single dead elephant's tusks are estimated to have a raw value of $21,000, according to a report by the Wildlife Trust. By comparison, the estimated value of tourism of a single elephant is $1,607,000. In other words, the countries that have got it and understand that, wait a minute, you can have thousands of ecotourists flocking to your country to witness these beautiful elephants who, the numbers were stunning to me how the populations have shrank. But if you could protect them, the kind of money, the kind of growth, job growth, economic activity in a lot of these developing nations is extraordinary.
And you can watch an elephant 20 times, 100 times, 1,000 times. You can shoot it only once. So you have more people interested in the watching, so there's greater economic potential there. And because of the nature of the activity, because you can replicate a non-harmful action over and over again, the economic potential there. So there's no comparison at all. You're absolutely right. This man did read the book. It's incredible.
Well, any writing, I'm in politics, so about elephants, I'm very interested in what's going on. And as a Democrat, I do not think we should shoot. No shooting.
None of us probably in this room cares a great deal about going hunting. I live in South Carolina. I'm from South Carolina, and, you know, hunting is extremely popular there. And people defend it because, for example, deer, there's an overpopulation of deer, and they're just essentially culling the herd. People do eat what they kill. The only thing more popular than hunting in South Carolina is marrying cousins. But But I just wonder, you know, and hunting is not going to go away. And I can actually make a case for hunters in the conservation area because, for example, Ducks Unlimited, you know, they buy up great big parcels of land and they preserve the lands because they want to duck hunt there. They brought back big populations of birds and that sort of thing. Is there any defense of this in the way you all view the world and the way the Humane Society views the world?
Well, you know, I think if we eat meat, you could make an argument that it's actually more humane to shoot a deer, and if you do it reliably and don't cause the animal to suffer very much, compared to getting animal products from a factory farm where the animals are suffering every single day. Now, at the same time, we're not going to be able to feed 320 million people by hunting and gathering in the United States. And I think for most of the deer hunters in South Carolina or West Virginia or Maryland, other states, it's a small supplement to their overall food budget. I think for so many species, there really is not much of a food gathering rationale. Mourning dove hunting is pretty popular in the South too, but there's hardly any meat on these little birds. I mean, it really amounts to target shooting of these animals. So if we really held hunters to the standard that they're going to eat what they kill, that they give the animals a chance to escape, a lot of hunting would fade away. I mean, we have bear baiting, we have captive hunting. I mean, most of those African lions that come into the U.S. are shot in fenced enclosures in South Africa. Of the 720 lions that came into the U.S., a majority of them were shot in fenced areas. So one of the things we say at the Humane Society is, you know, let's join with hunters who really believe in the principles of fair chase, as they call it, and utilizing the carcass, and let's stop these terrible practices like baiting and captive hunting. And, you know, why does anyone kill a wolf? A wolf is the antecedent or the precursor of the domesticated dog. Nobody eats dogs. You know, you don't eat predators. Why are we killing them? So,
but can I add something? Because so New Jersey, we have fierce debates, not about elephants or gorillas, but about deer and the deer population. And people want to know, we shouldn't let the deer population get so thick that they are starving.
Starving, that's right.
And I hear all these debates. And then it was amazing. You have one section that talks about different way. It's a false choice to say between the slaughter of animals, in this case it was horses, that are overpopulating and versus allowing them just to go wild and not killing them. There's science, and this is what I love, in multiple parts in your book, you talk about how we are advancing as a society. And one thing to do is just a humane birth control. And you have a wonderful story about you getting up with a woman who was an incredible shot.
Yeah.
and could tag...
Stella Trueblood.
I want a name like that.
Yes.
Trueblood.
Yeah, well, we went out because, you know, in the West, there are wild horses and burros. And there's a 1971 law, federal law, that protects wild horses and burros. Yet there are resource conflicts. The ranchers don't like the fact that the wild horses and burros are eating grass because they want the grass on our public lands for their cows.
Lots of grass debates in America right now.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, there are. So we have been urging the Bureau of Land Management to use fertility control for wild horses rather than round them up. And the principle was we're going to round them up and adopt them out to people. But they've rounded up so many that now we have 50,000 horses that are in federal holding facilities. And two-thirds of the Bureau of Land Management's budget, which was supposed to be a wild horse and burro in the wild management program, is feeding captive horses and renting the property. But if we did fertility control, we could manage them in the wild, controlling their numbers and balancing the different interests. So here's a case, and I think this is a big part of the book, that technology and innovation are going to give us options that we never had before. And it's going to free us in some ways to make better moral choices. And whether that's plant-based proteins in the food area or lab culture meat, or it's fertility control, or it's 21st century science in a laboratory that makes animal testing look perfectly, you know, obsolete and like a relic, we have options in this day and age. And I think more than ever we can be animal advocates because we're free of these very tough moral choices.
And can you go through some of the math for me? Because Wayne is going to do the Bill Maher show, which I'm very excited like next Friday.
They love you there when I talk to them.
Bill is a Jersey boy, so we bond over.
Is he vegan? He looks like he could be.
He. What are you trying to say about us?
No, I must say I didn't know you could be 6'3" and be a vegan. I really didn't. I thought you had to eat large chunks of beef.
There are great vegan bodybuilders, Olympic athletes. So, but Bill is vegan-ish, which is a thing I've heard now. But after there's a wonderful restaurant I went to after the Bill Maher show, and I took my cousin. So these are African American women that I took, and I was telling them, "Oh, guys, I'm going to take you to a vegan restaurant," and they're like, "Oh, great, Corey, yay!" and so they surreptitiously ate before they went out with me because they were so terrified of the food being horrible. But I took them to Crossroads, and we sat down, and they said, "You've got to try this." The chef came out. We haven't really let anybody try this, but this is the future of hamburgers. It's an impossible meat, and we brought it out. And to watch their faces when they bit into this, and even mine, because I've been eating veggie burgers since, but this was like a beef patty, the same consistency, the taste. I was shocked, and to see them, it was unbelievable. Then, you know, they had vegan chicken parmesan, which my aunt says is better than any. So the food is getting, the science is getting so much better. But even if you can create similar taste, this is what I want to ask you again: the moral math. What is the difference between that Impossible Foods hamburger, which I think is going to come out in about a year? Please trust me. This was stunning to me because it bleeds like a hamburger.
Oh, gosh. That's the worst part. It's
behaves like a hamburger. Patties on the grill. The whole thing. What is the difference to if the taste is the same, why, as a society, should we be favoring one over the other? What does it mean, that one patty?
Plus, it's also so much healthier, right?
Yeah. Well, he's just throwing a softball to me right over the plate. Thank you for this.
This is being live-streamed, and I want my cousins are watching. Yes. I want them to...
So, I think, you know, the whole history of the human experience is about change, right, and innovation. I mean, it was fanciful to think about flight, you know, before the Wright brothers did so. It was crazy to think about computers before somebody did it. It was wild to think about a smartphone. It was unimaginable before someone did it. Why can't we, this incredible species with this great creativity and ingenuity, figure out a way to mimic the best qualities of meat in terms of taste and texture and palatability? To do that without any of the moral costs in terms of the suffering of the animals, and without nearly the environmental impacts. I mean, it was 40 years ago, Frances Moore LePay wrote a book called Diet for a Small Planet, where she said that animals are protein factories in reverse, that they take an enormous amount of plant matter and turn it into a small amount of animal protein, because animals are burning energy, they're you know, they have waste, they've got organ functions. So the ratios are, you know, 10 or 12 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef, 7 or 8 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of pork, 3 or 4 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of chicken. Now, that's why 80% of
corn... What about the water?
Yeah, it's 80% of corn and soybeans are fed to animals, not to people. And then the water use, I mean, if you're talking about going west of the 20-inch rain line where we need irrigation, I mean, water is one of the most important resources. Obviously, California has been in the throes of a drought. Texas has had problems. In the world, water is a big resource. We have 77 billion animals raised for food in the world right now. We have 7 billion people. That means there are 10 animals being raised for human consumption for every person. In the United States, the average American eats 30 animals a year. You eat, you know, part of a cow, part of a pig, like 28 chickens, another animal. Imagine if the world was eating 30 animals per person. We'd have 240 billion animals. 70% of our Earth's surface is covered by water. Of the 30% of our terrestrial landscape, so much of it is rock and ice and desert. The habitable portion of our planet is finite. We cannot afford to do what we're doing. And these technologies are going to offer us the prospect of feeding the hungry, keeping us healthy, and save animals.
But it's more than that. If I can add, I know we have to stop for a second, but you're missing some other facts. For every pound of...
I've read this book, too, and I have some things to say.
Okay, but I just want to add, for every pound of meat, you're producing 3 pounds of feces. And what this is doing to our...
Untreated
feces. So what this is doing to the poisoning of our lakes, our rivers, our aquifers, is stunning environmental damage that's being done right now by that much feces. And unfortunately, the globe is shifting towards a Western diet, which is a heavy meat diet, and we cannot sustain this movement. And that's why you see guys like Bill Gates, who's not a vegan, but rushing to invest in these companies that can invent our way out of this dependency.
Yeah, there's some great tips in here for investments. And I want to tell you about one right now before we have to open the floor to questions. But one of the things that I loved in the book, having read the whole thing, I love the chapter that talked about these new food products that are being created, and not just the Miracle Burger, the Impossible Burger, which I can't wait to try. But you were talking about labs. They're growing meat in labs, meat, quote unquote, by using, well, it's not 100% vegan because you do use some cells taken by simple biopsy, and they take those into the lab and use those to sort of, it's kind of like, I guess, the starter stuff for your sourdough bread, you know? It's like we take these little cells and put them in a... You tell it, because you went and actually visited this place.
Yeah, no, I mean... And you had a moral... You had to tell about your moral...
Yeah, well,
moment.
I'd been a vegan for so long that I was like, am I going to eat this lab meat? Am I going to still be a vegan if I eat it? And, you know, I did eat the chip, the beef jerky.
This is called eating at the cellular level, right?
Yeah. But no, I mean, these guys are serious. I mean, we're already doing cell cultures to produce insulin for diabetics. Cell culture growth is a big thing. Why can't we do it in a laboratory to grow meat without the heart, without the brain, so you don't have any of the moral problems associated with it? I think, you know, it's not perfect now. I can just predict, just like we've seen with computing and so many other areas in the world of innovation, things are going to get better and better, and it's going to give us more options. You know, we're a pluralistic group at the Humane Society of the U.S. We don't say, you've got to be a vegan, you've got to be a vegetarian. Our metric is progress, not perfection. If you're, you know, an inveterate carnivore, just go meatless on Mondays, or just, you know, skip a meal, make it a plant-based meal. If you want to just help dogs and cats, go to Lost Dog and Cat Rescue, you know, which is one of our hosts tonight. I got my little Lily, Lisa and I got Lily from Lost Dog and Cat Rescue, and that is a wonderful life-saving thing to do. There are little things that each of us can do to make the world better for animals. And at the end of the book, I have 10 ways that you can help build a humane economy, and I hope all of you will take a look at that.
I did have one other thought. I mean, maybe we're wrapping up, but is there any effort being put into educating, you know, school curricula and talking about animal welfare? And, you know, there's nothing like the children coming home and saying, oh, I'm not going to eat that chicken. Do you know how much that chicken suffered? And then they'll start spouting off. No.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously kids are getting information through all sorts of portals today, not just school. But we do have a program. We do have a magazine for kids. And, you know, I think a real generational change is coming. I mean, we're all old enough where, you know, this wasn't part of the discourse as much when we were kids. Now it's part of our national discourse. And I think that great changes are upon us because people get it about animals. And if we can find a way not to harm them, why don't we do that? It's just that simple.
Well, and the easy thing is just to simply pay attention to your meat. You know, it's to find out where it was raised, how it was raised. Kind of like, I don't know if you all ever watched Portlandia, but the couple in the restaurant is saying, well, now, where did this chicken grow up? And did he have friends? What was his name? And was he, you know, was he fed properly? And so you don't have to go that far, but it is possible to make sure you buy meat from, you know, places that care about that sort of thing and monitor. California, and this is when Orville Schell came out with his book, Modern Meat. And I went to the grocery store and bought a package of meat and tried to trace it all the way back to its origin. And it was quite a Byzantine journey, and there were lots of places along the way where there was nothing, no one really paying close attention, you know, from the food they were provided and on and on. But it was a fascinating, reporter's story because it was just... there were so many different stages in that process, and it was kind of mind-boggling and kind of awful as well. But, you know, that's another thing you can do if you do like meat, is to find out where it came from.
And I'll just add that, but I hated him in 2013 because I was a vegetarian, not a vegan, and we would go out to dinner together, and he wouldn't judge me, and I was like...
Judge me.
Judge me, for crying out loud. He was so nice. He was like, no, you know, that's okay, man. You know, it's all right. And I felt so unjudged by him, and it was frustrating to me, but that's my philosophy, which is just, you know what, we all should just be the best version of ourselves. Live as hard as it is, and I fall every day. I'm not living. I fall short of my best version all the time. But we should try to get better and better and better. And the one thing I love about this book, but I say this about other things, is let's just be more conscious of what's going on around us. And you say this in the book, something I say all the time, that in a democracy like we do live in a free market society, the way you have of influencing this society every day, you vote every single day with the consumer choices you make, what you spend your money on. And by creating walls of ignorance and not having consciousness, you are actually, and this is what King said so eloquently, it's not the vitriolic words and violent actions of the bad people, but the appalling silence and inaction of the good people. It's a willful ignorance. And I'm not good at this. I have no idea where this suit was made, or who made it, or what conditions were they working on. One of the things Mark Bittman, who I know is a friend of all of us up here, another extraordinary columnist, but he talks about, when he was talking about the food industry, one of his final columns was talking about, what do we know about the people that are serving food? We spend about $90 billion annually with public benefits for people that serve us food, work in the kitchens, because the money they make doesn't cover it, so they rely on food stamps. They rely on public housing. And I know that consumers, if they know a little bit more, we would become a more moral society. So the challenge to us isn't bad people trying to do bad things. It's just our willingness to tolerate things. And you document so many cases in our country where once we learned about dolphins and tuna fish, or once we learned about the veal industry, we actually make changes. And I had a moment where I was sitting with a woman who I love, our Secretary of HHS, and she and I were talking, and we were talking about my passion. I was pressing her about antibiotics in our meats. And this is a global crisis. The majority of the antibiotics used in this country are being pumped into our animals, and it's creating superbugs that are antibiotic resistant. This is threatening humanity on this planet, the way we're recklessly using antibiotics and just pumping them into animals. And she says to me, which I thought was such an enlightened thing, and you write about in your book, it's like, look, we should fight this battle. I'm partnering on a bill with some others, Dianne Feinstein and others, to try to deal with this issue. But one company, McDonald's, as you showed in one example in your book, one corporation that makes a difference, because they're realizing that it's in their economic interest, because so many people are aware of this issue. One company like Walmart changes their practices. It changes the whole chain and makes changes much more dramatically. And so the corporations deal with consumers. We ultimately have the ability to shape a corporation behavior. But if we're not exercising that because of willful ignorance, and I've had friends, and I was one of those people, I found myself eating eggs, trying my best not to think about what I knew about the eggs. And it's that willful ignorance that undermines our ability to live to our best selves. So I'm not saying everybody should be vegan. I'm not saying everybody should be vegetarian. I just think we all should try every day, every month, every quarter, or every year that we set our goals to live a little bit more consciously. Not try to trace your meat all the way back to its mom and dad. That's pretty impressive.
A story.
Okay. But lifting the veil a little bit makes us more conscious consumers.
I just want to say one final thing. I just want to say one thing, and that is that I thank God every single day that wine does not come from animals.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.